nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so we'll start with Lecture 8 on the mechanics of defect generation and gate dielectric breakdown. Around 1999 or 2000, there was a sort of a mini crisis in the semiconductor industry, that as gate oxides have gotten thinner and thinner, as you know, over the years, as the channel length has shrunk, there was a big question that whether gate oxide can remain reliable below 3 nanometer. And there are several companies which sort of delayed their product shipment because of the reliability concern. And that is when it crystallized this notion of reliability being a very important component for the growth of Moore's law, sort of became very crystal clear. And there was a lot of beautiful experiments done around that time. What I'm going to tell you is a story from that time, but of course, done in the, I'm looking back, so many things are probably a little bit more organized than it was in that time. But these are sort of high-stake games. So, of course, it means a lot. Getting the physics right means a lot of things. So I'll start with a theory of oxide breakdown. I'll talk about the notion of statistics of failure distribution. This is the key. We'll talk about soft and hard breakdown. When oxides are thick, when they break in such a violent way that one single break essentially destroys the whole thing. When oxides are thin, and when they break, it's like a little whimper. I have a little fountain of electron coming out, another fountain of electron coming out, another fountain, but it doesn't simply destroy it altogether. That's hard and soft breakdown. Without this, none of your computer would have worked. In fact, as you're checking your email, many is doing this soft breakdown many times in your email, in your computer already. And I'll talk a little bit about correlated and uncorrelated breakdown to prepare you for the thick gate dielectric for the next lecture. That is becoming very important for various applications, and then I conclude. Now, I have shown you this plot before, so you will remember that we cannot test an oxide at the operating voltage because it takes too long. Rather, we would do so at higher voltages, and as a result, we'll get the corresponding lifetime, time to break down, shown here as circles, green, magenta, and red circles. And instead of doing a straight line, like an empirical projection, we would do a curved line. Now, what curved line? Now, there will be a curved line, because I said this is a stochastic process terminated by a threshold. So there will be a curved line. But the curvature and the curve will be determined by the physics. Every time you have a different problem, you shouldn't draw the same line. It should be sort of different. So you shouldn't look for a function. It should be dictated by physics. You understand the physics, the curve will come automatically, right? You get the idea. And you can see why it should go to infinity. If you haven't applied any voltage on your computer and just put it down, buy it and put it in your desk, don't connect it to the power supply, hopefully it will last more than 30 years. So you can see that why a linear projection may not be a good idea to begin with. Okay, so the idea, before I get in the discussion of the physics, I want to emphasize this very important distinction between thick and thin oxides, a fundamentally different thing. When you have thin oxides, then the transport is ballistic, because electron goes from one side to another through the oxide band gap. Oxide here is shown in yellow, and you can see the band gap could be 9 eV, much larger than the silicon band gap, let's say, on left and right side. And in this case, the red one is the electron distribution. You remember from Professor Dutta's lecture and Professor Lundstrom's lecture that if you have Fermi level from one side, Fermi level in another side, he told you about electron transport, ballistic electron transport from one side to another. Now, of course, people ask that at what channel length things become ballistic, whether at 20 nanometers ballistic or not, graphene ballistic or not. People talk about these things. But it has been ballistic for the electrons for gate oxide breakdown and those type of transport issues from early 1980s. It has been always been ballistic. So if you want to verify the theory of ballistic transport, this is the first thing one should look at. And the notion of contact playing in the Lander formulation, contact playing the fundamental role, right? Contact is everything. That will also come through this picture beautifully, because you'll see PMOS and NMOS will behave fundamentally different way, not because of the oxide, but because the two sides have different types of doping. Completely different pictures it will emerge. Now, this is very different, by the way. By the way, also for spintronics giant magnetoresistance effect, then you generally include a insulator in between the magnetic contacts, again for the same reason, so that you can go from one side to another without scattering in the metal, right? So that's also the same reason you want to put a insulator at low voltages. For thick oxides, however, this is a different issue. Contact is not that important. Just like a long channel device, electrons bouncing back and forth, and then that's the hole, and the hole bouncing back, and then it'll be breakdown. But you can see the breakdown, essentially after a little bit, it will forget about what contact it came from. It will bounce so many times with the atoms of the silicon dioxide that all its properties are dictated by silicon dioxide. It doesn't care about contacts anymore. Only then the breakdown becomes a property of silicon dioxide. For thin oxides, yes, silicon dioxide is there, but contact is everything. That is what I want to show you a little bit later. So this is the generic picture that I'll be using, and this is called an anode hole injection picture. And anode hole injection in the sense that I have taken a cut across the channel. This is the substrate of the channel. This is the gate polysilicon, and this is the oxide. And if I apply a positive bias on the gate, I'm explaining this formula. Time to break down, how it depends on various things. So let me first explain. If I apply a positive bias, then I can see it's a top view of the structure. The electrons will tunnel. And if the electron tunnels on the other side from this contact to the other one, then it will impact ionize. This is a hypothesis. I'm saying a hypothesis. I'll prove it later. Impact ionize in the contact, the poly contact, and holes will be injected back. And as the holes come through, a fraction of them will be captured. And that will make it a weakened bond. Remember that silicon-oxygen bonds, and then there was this, they are being pulled together by, hold together by two bonds. And if you catch a hole, then you have only one electron sharing between them. You apply a little electric field, it breaks. And then you have the dangling bond. Do you remember from the previous lecture? So you have created a defect. And so, in order to know how long will it take before this oxide will break, that depends on how many electron current is flowing ballistically through this channel, quote-unquote channel, this oxide. And then what is the impact ionization? The contact is hot because it is losing all its energy in the contact, right? And so, depending on that, that will be the impact ionization rate, back injection from the hot contact, that is the transmission rate, and the trap generation efficiency, because not all the holes will be trapped. It has to go through a region where it can be trapped, and then it will be broken. And so you can see, higher the hole flux back, lower will be your current. Lower will be your time to break down. So you can see, therefore, I have all these factors, electron, impact ionization, transmission, all of them in the denominator. NBD is number of bonds that needs to be broken before I have a short circuit. And I will calculate that a little bit later. But the point is, all the voltage dependence thing, that at high voltage how it breaks, a little lower voltage how it breaks, remember that nonlinear curve? the physics of the nonlinear car is hidden in the physics of this carrier transport and hot electron injection back, right? So that is, I'm looking for that blue curve, the curvature of the blue curve. That is what I'm after. So let me take it one at a time. So one thing is that you should be able to calculate these numbers. You know, tunneling, this is no problem. Everybody can do it. You can use a simple WKB formula if it's appropriate. You can use NEGF formulation if that is appropriate. However way you want to do it, you calculate the transmission coefficient and the electron current, compare with experiment, and so on and so forth. You can do that, and you can fit it with experiment pretty well. This is something I did long time ago. This is almost 10 years now. So you can get a model, a very good tunneling model that fits 65, 45, 35, 25, 50, and all of them, it does very well. And so this is actually telling you how good oxides have become, that you can take a theory that you think up in your head in a random material, and steel essentially can predict the current. It's a miracle in some way. It's a random material. Not even a clean band structure in that sense. Steel, you can do a pretty good job in terms of calculating the tunneling current. One part done. The second part you do is, this is the applied voltage, and this is the impact ionization coefficient, alpha. I'm sorry, it should be shifted a little bit. This alpha is this. And one thing you realize, that this is a log plot, and alpha to the power 0, 1 or 2 is around here. So this is one thing that you should remember, that no matter how much energy you come up with, it's very difficult to get more than 2 or 3 electron generated per injected electron. Impact ionization coefficient is hardly more than 2 and 3 at high energy. When you have a lot of energy, the phonons steal away your energy very quickly. Right, you have one scattering, and then the phonons take away quite a bit of your energy. So it's very difficult to go beyond 2 or 3. So therefore, it flattens out. But at low energy, what happens? That, of course, the probability that with low energy you will generate few hot holes, that reduces very quickly, exponentially. Right? You do not have that much energy, and so this is the curve. Once again, you can do it by Monte Carlo. This is routinely done. And then the transmission coefficient back, you can do that, calculate that, make the measurement, and make a prediction. Now, I'll not go through the details. I mean, these are published papers. You can take a look. The point is that you can take all these three factors, calculate the whole current, and you can look at the lifetime breakdown as a function of the electric field. I'm sorry, it should, okay, electric field, and verify it under wide variety of conditions. For example, this is the electric field. These are experimental data, and just 1 over JH. So it's shifted by a constant, right? I do not know NBD, number of traps it requires to break down. But these are all same oxides, so I can shift it by a constant. But the point is, by just taking those three things and taking 1 over, you can essentially explain the experimental data very, very well for different thicknesses, for plus voltage, for minus voltages. You can explain the experiment very well. So this was very good. This model is telling you that how the blue curve is going to shift. Do you see? This is how, as a function of electric field, how as a lower electric field, you cannot just take these 3 points and draw a straight line, right? And so you can see the physics that has to go in this case. In the previous case, it was P minus half, because in that case, that was a diffusion physics. So here is the anode hole injection physics. It's a slightly different. And so these are, again, experimental data from many different groups. This is the theoretical prediction based on the anode hole injection model. You just multiply them, and as a function of voltage, you just calculate the numbers, and you can correspondingly find out what the lifetime is going to be. And this lifetime will be much higher. Now, the thing is that if you just took this, by the way, what is this? This is voltage acceleration factor. It is saying it is the slope of this line. If you have a certain slope, you can see the slope is increasing, and the slope is increasing up to 8 decades per volt. Do you know what it means? That if you go from 2 volt to 1 volt, had your transistor lived for 1 day, one day at 2 volts, it will live for 10 years at 1 volt. 8 orders of magnitude, right? Because so that is how dramatic improvement it is. Why is it? It is because at low voltages, you do not have any impact ionization. When the electrons coming in, the contacts are warm. It's getting cooler. And so it cannot inject back holes. And without holes, there's no damage. And this is a nonlinear function. It's not like an exponential or anything. It's a nonlinear function because at zero voltage, you don't have any impact ionization effectively. As a result, you have this dramatic improvement in the lifetime of oxides. If you didn't know this, you'd be very hard-pressed to make any integrated circuit. But in fact, if you just knew this, you'd be actually in trouble because this will tell you that this is going up so dramatically, then the safe operating voltage could be as much as 2.3 volts. Yeah, you put it in your computer and Intel will be out of business immediately because there is another thing that comes in, and that is the statistics of the distribution, right? And that is something I'm coming. Physics of NBT. I just told you about the physics of voltage acceleration, how the average changes. But average is essentially doesn't mean anything, because average at the end of the day means that when 50% of your transistors of your IC is gone, well, you are dead much before your 50% is gone. One is gone, yeah, the computer is returned. So statistics is everything. And let me show you how the statistics come into the play. And you can see how dangerous this statistics business is. Because if you have a transistor that has a billion transistor in there, right? These days, I was telling Professor Lundstrom that a full stop at the end of your page may contain 1 million transistors. This is how small things have gotten. Now, it's not just that. You should be able to, the way the prices are set, prices of the ICs are set, you should be able to sell 10,000 of them and no more than one will come back, statistically speaking. So that means you cannot allow more than 1 in 10 to the power 13 number of transistors to fail. Because, you know, as soon as one fails, that person brings back the computer. So no more than 1 in 10 to the power 13. There's no computer in the world without physics that will help you to define this level of distribution, tail of the distribution. Impossible, right? How many samples are you going to simulate with a supercomputer? So this is something very fundamental, and that was not initially very well understood. That got us into a lot of trouble. So let's talk about that statistics, the fluctuation and the variation. So you remember the problem, right? When the oxide essentially defects line up, then there's a breakdown, and you can see why it will be a statistical thing. If you have a million transistors sitting around, everybody is sort of, it's like a bingo game. Everybody is putting their own crosses in their respective bingo sheet. It turns out that this is only 5 levels in this direction and many levels on the other direction. So many opportunities to say that you are done. The thing is, therefore, this will be statistical. But one thing realize, we are talking about 1993. People do not think about it in this way. There's no percolation at that time. No view that this could be a way of our thinking the problem. Now I'm telling you that you can think about it, it's becoming obvious. But at that time, people have no idea percolation exists. They have an effective breakdown field. They are seeing the effective breakdown field is all over. Process engineers are being told, you better improve the process. What are you making that is failing randomly left and right? You see, the picture hasn't emerged. And you see that after the picture emerges, you realize no matter how good the process is, these are fundamental limits. You can do nothing. You'll have to avoid it for the following reason. Because what happens, as I said, that the time to break down is a statistical thing. And what will happen that if you take at a given voltage, let's focus on the red. It's a high voltage. And if you take 100 transistor, and sit down and make measurements, then what's going to happen is not everybody will fail at the same time. Some unlucky one we'll have the channel shorted or the oxide shorted early on compared to others. And so you'll have a distribution. The amazing thing people saw very early days that if you do it at a little bit lower voltage, of course the average will shift, right? That's the blue curve, lower voltage. But amazingly, these lines are sort of parallel. That's interesting. It just got shifted, but still parallel. And the green one is doing the same thing. But first, let me tell you the problem is. So if you just focused on the average lifetime, this is 50% on this curve. F is 50.5. If you put it 0.5, then you will get something like a number like this. If you just extrapolate it, it would say that the technology will live forever, hundreds of years. But you see, you have to ensure that no more than 1 in 10 to the power 13 fails. And this is your distribution. This is your distribution. So by the time you put F equals 10 to the power minus 13, you can see what's going to happen, that this line, which is parallel to this, will come all the way here. And then that will have a lifetime maybe less than 10 years. Then you cannot sell that product. You see the problem? Average lifetime, you did a nice theory, nice extrapolation, linear extrapolation. You are sort of may have thought that it's okay. But the statistics is killing you. So we'll have to understand, is this something you can improve by process improvement, right? Maybe if I do processing, if you give the process engineers a bonus, they will make it straight. Or is it fundamental that this is how it is, how life is? So, I'm going to now bring back that percolation model. Remember, I was doing it as for the channel length. This time, I'll just rotate it 90 degrees and use the same thing over here. Yes.
At the high voltage, we still have, as you mentioned, have the phenomena of ionization and impact ionization. So, while the lines are parallel at the lower voltage, we might not have those phenomena coming into play, especially the operating voltage.
As I will show you, that the rate of defect generation, how many red boxes you create per second, that depends on the voltage. But how they arrange it, at least for the voltage range we are talking about, that is statistically independent. And you'll have to prove that experimentally. If it is statistically independent, then the lines will be parallel. Lines will be shifting with respect to each other at a different rate, but the slope of that line, they'll be the same, so long as uncorrelated. Okay. Now, I will use the same model, except remember the difference between reliability and percolation, that it is time ordered, right? So, anytime I will do the same N, but I will make sure that time now comes in into the game and more defects are formed later than less defects. You can do the same thing. You are experts now, hopefully. I have a percolation path of M defects. Q to the power m, Q being the rate at which the probability that a site is occupied, the probability goes up as a function of time. The alpha can be 1, it can be a different one. You can experimentally determine it, depends on the rate of generation, right? The impact ionization and all other things, tunneling will hide in this T naught and in that alpha. So the voltage acceleration will tell me. And I will do the, so if you put this Q, this one in here, you will see that essentially P will become T to the power M alpha, and M alpha, M is a thickness, alpha is some exponent, we'll name it beta, because beta will come often in various things, so we'll call it beta. Now, you know this, so I'll not spend too much time. What is this? Probability of not failing, right? Because nobody is shorted. 1 minus P is nobody is shorted. So it's an N being this number of columns, nobody is shorted. And for the P, you can write NP divided by N. And if your N is large enough, exponential of NP. You can write that. And probability of not failing, this is a cumulative probability. So you can also write it as 1 minus FP this way. And just take a log. That's it. That's all there is physics there is to it. Take two logs. This two-log business has a name. It's called a weighable distribution. In 1950s, it was originally seen in 19 Abrami when he was looking at crystallization. Remember I said that many things are self-similar? crystallization is one of those things. And so self-similarity was something, this function he used, but it was really popularized in 1950s by Weibull, who was looking at the wear out of airline wings. Because remember, if it wears out too quickly, then you have to replace them or fix them. So it was originally derived from that context, but for the time being, this double log of 1 minus f, f is a cubability probability, that's called a Weibull, so I'll write a w here. Now let's see, if I take one log, I'll bring out n and p, right? If I take another log, then it will become log n and log p. But this p has t minus t naught to the power beta. So if you take two logs, you'll see the beta coming in here. So what is it telling you? It is telling you that if you plot the failure distribution, so if you have 100 transistors, first transistor breaks, f is 0.01, second 0.02, so you'll insert this value, and you'll insert when they fail, t1, t2, t3, and plot it, and look for this beta. That's the slope. And the main prediction is, slope of this plot should be proportional to thickness. There's nothing you can do to get around it, right? That's what this theory is saying. Why it's proportional? Because remember, this beta is the slope in this plot, and the beta is given by m alpha. M is the thickness. So if you go from 4 nanometer to 3 nanometer, what is going to happen? Your slope will go down, right? And the lower slope is bad. Yes?
Does it depend on the times that you pick, or is your time the t
T is not a random variable. I have, let's say, I have put in my tester 100 transistors, right? Then after a little bit, I see that this transistor is dead. 57th transistor is dead, let's say. So I will pick down that what is my time, let's say 25 seconds, and 1 out of 100 has failed. So F is 0.01, T is 25 seconds. A little bit later, 36 seconds, I see the second one has failed. So F is 0.02, T is 36 seconds. So I will keep plotting and then try to interpret experimentally and try to interpret with this formula. Is this clear? This is a very, very important point. How you experimentally, you will just have a collection of F and T. You plot it in your page however you like it. This is theory. Theory is saying T and W should go in a particular way. So this is the theory. You can see which one is thicker, do you think? This one has a lower slope, right? And higher slope, so this must be thicker. And this one, this is theory. And this is a lower slope, and you will do it at the homework this afternoon. This will come from here. I'm sorry, the T-ox should have gone the other way. I'm sorry, the arrow should have gone the other way. And you can see that as you reduce your thickness, your variable slope from simulation, this beta, is gradually going down. Right? That's what theory is saying. Theory is no problem. You can say that. And sure enough, once people collected, you see, this is a surprise. I'm talking about when percolation theory didn't exist. First time, random people doing experiment all over the world, seeing they are saying, fighting whether process variation is the cause for this, you take all the data and put it in the plot, T-ox as a function of variable, sure enough, it's a straight line. And at that point, they gave up on process improvement because you cannot do anything with it. This is an intrinsic thing. When oxide is this thin, 3 nanometer oxide will always have a higher slope than 2 nanometer oxide. And when you have a 2 nanometer oxide and want to extrapolate with a lower slope, it will cut down at a lower time. So your lifetime will be small. You cannot do anything about it. You have to live with it. So there are, based on, this is a homework. So the way people do it these days, based on the formula that I just showed you, using that, you can take a test structure. This is a test. And then for the 50% average lifetime, beta you measure, and then scale it up to the area, because if there's a probability that it fails at a certain time, larger area device will fail faster, because there are many independent things that can go wrong. And then from 50%, you will have to make it to 10 to the power minus 13 because, you know, that's how many probabilities that you can tolerate. And from that, calculate V-safe. Just try to derive this equation. I'll not try to do that. From the past five slides is all you need to derive this. This is how, if you go join any company, this is how they are going to qualify their oxide, whether it's good or not. And before shipping that per PC, this is what they are, your iPod, this is what they're going to do. Now, I have told you how it is done. But then there's another surprise, right? So one surprise gone, another surprise. So what happened? I have shown you an ITRS roadmap. First, let's focus on the black line. It's 2001, but that really doesn't matter here. What I'm showing that at 2001, the ITRS is a sort of, you know, is a consortium. They say, they dictate what should be the oxide thickness, what should be the channel length, what should be the supply voltage, so on and so forth. And they were saying that as you are scaling down for performance reason, by the time you are around 1 nanometer, you shouldn't go below a volt. And this is historical. So when you're at 5 nanometer, maybe you can stay at 1.75 volts for performance for that day. Okay, so this is what they wanted. And the calculation procedure I just told you about. So people sat down and then they calculated. And the thing is, the NMOS, look at these blue points based on that formula and experiment. At 1 volt, the safe operating voltage was much higher than 1 volt that you needed. At 1 nanometer, it was higher. So it's good, right? I can operate it safely at higher voltage. I don't have to worry about NMOS. But what happened is that red line. In PMOS, it showed that if you try to go along in this line, yes, NMOS will pass, but the PMOS at 2 nanometer, if you try to put more than 0.5 volts, you are dead. Now remember the dilemma. I have the same oxide, same material. PMOS and NMOS, why should the lifetime be so different? I mean, there's no obvious reason that these two has to be different in this particular way, right? So this is the question, and you can immediately see now that what fundamental roles contacts play. This is the Landauer formulation and how contacts actually governs everything. This is a crystal clear example. There's no dilemma about this. Yes.
Why is there a slope difference for the oxide thicknesses between 1 and 1.5 nanometers and 0.5
nanometers? Just a second. First of all, sorry that this all got shifted in my PowerPoint. But tell me again, which point should I point out? This one?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, ITRS roadmap, this is a committee that sits around. And then there are equipment manufacturers and the industry people. And so let's say Applied Material is selling the equipment. And they can say that given the time frame, they say this is tagged with a particular year, this is tagged with a particular year, that we should be able to go along this line. And the performance people, so this is, it's a committee line, meaning a committee sits down and decide. There's no physics in it. So the physics is in the, if you want to ask me, then you can ask me about this one. But that committee one, I'm not a part of it. Pardon me?
If you
scale down further, this is, what do you mean? It's not, so long this blue line is above the black line, that means the safe operating voltage at that oxide thickness is higher than what is required for performance. So if you need a 1 gigahertz processor, for that, you can use NMOS safely. That's what it's saying. So long it's above, you don't care. But if it is below, then you are in trouble, right? Because you want to use it at 1 volt, and PMOS will die at 1 volt. Okay. And this is something that was a puzzle, and it turns out that if you understand contacts, you will understand it very, very easily. That you see, we talked about the hole current being the source. And the hole current in the NMOS, this is the gate, So what type of voltage in the gate do you apply in NMOS when, if you want to invert it? Positive bias, right? So I have applied a positive bias, electron coming from the substrate to the gate, and then it is causing an impact ionization. And in this case, impact ionization, generally we know that an electron will be pumped up. A hole will leave behind, left behind, and the hole will go, right? Field is in this direction, so hole will go in that direction. And you will have some defects. This is sort of what we think is impact ionization. It is impact ionization. But in PMOS, something fundamentally different can happen. Yes, the regular process can happen, of course. Regular process. So an electron, there can be an electron here which has been kicked up and then it goes leaving behind a hole. But what can additionally happen is that because this is a P-type material, when you invert, because I'm having negative voltage on the gate, when you invert, there is this pocket of holes sitting there, right? A little pocket of holes. This pocket of holes, when an electron can drop down in that pocket of holes, now this has these holes that, so this is an electron here. This electron can come down. It can give all its energy to this electron, and this electron can go and sit in that pocket because there are empty states there. And as soon as that happens, you can see the energy of these holes will be 2 eV. If this band gap is 1 eV, 2 eV larger than what you would otherwise have in NMOS. These are very few in numbers, but in terms of barriers and in terms of being able to flow, this flux will completely dominate the whole current. You see? So therefore, you can see the PMOS will actually have much smaller lifetime. If you didn't think about contacts, if you're just looking at the oxide all day long, you'll never figure it out. So this is the only process in NMOS, electron coming down, and another one, the companion one going up, leaving behind a hole, and you have E injection minus EG being the energy of the hole. Yeah, this is way down in the valence band, and then lot big barrier of oxide sitting next to you. So it doesn't really do as much damage. On the other hand, for PMOS, look at how many processes are available. Of course, the classical process is obviously available, but now you have these additional things which couldn't happen in NMOS. That electron drops down to the conduction band, but from deep down, an electron is pumped up, not all the way to the conduction band, but to the bottom of the valence band because they are empty states. You can do this also. You can come down and all the way it can jump up. This is called majority versus minority ionization. In most cases, the minority ionization is minuscule. It wouldn't have mattered unless you have this oxide is as a filter. Yes, you have many of them, but they cannot go because there is a big barrier. And yes, you have a few of them, but those are the ones causing a lot of damage. You see? And that's why the PMOS and NMOS is so different. Certainly. You can see, what does using a different metal mean? It simply means that you have a different work function. Isn't it all this way of doping? Isn't it simply a way of controlling work function, effective work function in some way, right? So you have to have, of course, not just work function, you have to have that minority pocket where the electrons can come out. Right? And you have to have, of course, balance all the momentum and all other things. So therefore, probability is low. But experimentally and both theoretically, you can show that that's the one that causes. There's something called a carrier separation method. You can, in fact, show that this is indeed a dominant component of this. Okay? So hopefully now you'll remember that contacts are important, right? Okay. So if this is the case, and I'm talking about maybe 2002, 2003, then how come you have a computer and still buying it? Because the PMOS then should have died. What saved PMOS is something else. And that's what maybe remaining 10, 11 slides I'm going to explain to you. What saved PMOS is people always thought, anytime there's a breakdown, it causes violent destruction. And people always thought that that is the only way, because they were always testing at high voltage, right? Anytime they saw it under microscope, they of course saw something, some probes completely melted out. But of course, at lower voltages, you can see the voltage is low. And I have a series of slides at the end of the lecture which explains that how, at what point the breakdown need not be completely destructive. Because, you know, you have applied 1 volt and you have a resistance, you have a little short in one corner. It doesn't generate a lot of heat. It doesn't melt a lot of things around it. So it's just like a little tiny bit leakage. Now, these days, the oxides are so thin that you have so much gate leakage anyway. So a little tiny whimper of leakage, it shouldn't do you much harm. So that is what people began to suspect, because you can see that there is a step in the current. So you have first a jump, a tiny one, there's no violent signature of breakdown, then a quantized jump, then a quantized jump, and you will see this 3 or 4 times. And this is what we saw around, I'll say, 2002, 2003. We began to see that, just like, you know, quantum conductance, you see in the gate oxide breakdown a series of conductance plateau coming through. Something like this, and something like this. Jump, jump. By the way, you don't think that this is small, this is a log plot. So this is actually much bigger than the other one. Yeah, they're just plotting in a log plot. But the thing is, this quantized jump, it will go generally 3, 4, and I have measured myself at least probably close to 100. And then they all show this jump. So you can do a lot of statistics on it. But the thing is, now you realize that you don't have to really say that you are dead here. You can say, it just jumped a little current. So perhaps you will be able to use till you have the second breakdown or third breakdown. Wait till that point, and then you can say that the transistor is done. Yes? Obviously. You can see this, right? If you apply 5 volts, when all of a sudden you have a short, right? Short, then it'll be violent amount of power voltage discharge. It's a constant voltage supply. You have a resistance. So it's V multiplied by I. And in that case, a huge amount of power will go through this and it will melt it. But if it is 1 volt, power dissipation is so low that it will not be able to melt anything around it.
Okay. No. But my question was, for example, when you sweep the gate voltage, even...
You don't sweep the gate voltage. You hold the gate voltage and sit there.
That's right, but when you sweep it, you get different leakage.
Yes.
But in, for example, what...
No, this is not sweeping, you see. Let's say I have a capacitor.
How do you pick your gate voltage here?
I don't have to pick a voltage. Let's say 2 volts. Let me put 2 volts on it. And then in the beginning, this is the gate leakage current, independent. So there's defects forming in the background, nothing shorting. All of a sudden, one column forms, still 2 volts. Then it stays, still 2 volts. Then another column forms, jump. Right? This is how it works. And if you do it at 3 volt, 4 volts, you'll get different currents. So, therefore, anytime I have 1 in 10 to the power 13, I will not have to worry about it. Maybe I can survive 2. But you see, that gives me a huge improvement in lifetime, because 1 can be very unlucky. You know, accidentally 5. You're like winning lottery once when your 5 numbers line up. Winning lottery twice consecutively is probably very difficult, because that takes a lot of luck. Because other people can, in the meantime, win the lottery. So the probability that 2 breakdown will happen in the same transistor is actually very, very small, and therefore your lifetime then goes up quite a bit. Again, I'll not belabor these points. You can, now you are experts in this one. If you want n columns doing it, you will do NCN, this combination, p to the power n, you know, n parallel columns, 1 minus p, you do this whole thing, find out what the probability distribution is. You can check it out. Very simple. Plot the variable distribution and the measured data. And the first thing is, this is the same variable. It's for 1 oxide, so I have just 1 line, black line, n equals 1. This is a log plot. So the safe operating voltage now at the time of failure, first breakdown, is let's say 10 to the power 4 seconds. How much is 10 to the power 4 seconds? Couple of hours. So if you bought your computer without this advantage of this short breakdown, in 4 hours, you'll have to take it back. Now, of course, if you can wait till the second one, because the way what I'm doing is this black, red, and blue curves are essentially from the previous slide, essentially n equals 1, n equals 2, n equals 3. I'm just putting it in that formula. That's all I'm doing. And I'll show you in the last slide that how this experimentally are verified. And then you get a huge lifetime. 10 to the power 10 seconds is more than 10 years. And so all of a sudden, either it fails at few hours or it fails at 10 to the power after 10 years. Then you can ship these parts and it will still be okay. And you can derive various formulas, but let me just basically tell you the physics. You can see how much time this T2, this is statistical average, remember. You can do correspondingly for T3, and you can see how much improvement, T2 divided by T1 or T3 divided by T1, how much improvement in lifetime you get. And you can see that these solid lines are experiment theory, and these are experimental data that was verified based on, you know, remember I said that many samples were measured, so you can get the statistical distribution of T1, T2, and T3. And then you can, and if you go to the power 10 to the power minus 13, you can see you can get a huge improvement in lifetime. That is what saves your computer. Okay. And that is how actually you go, and this lifetime, the first breakdown is here, but the safe operating voltage you can push up because you don't need that much lifetime anymore. So you can trade it up, go to a higher voltage, and essentially make sure the second breakdown doesn't happen before the 10-year lifetime. Then it's okay. Yes?
So, this physics of breakdown is not important for NMOS?
Obviously, in NMOS will also give me an additional lifetime. But I'm rich enough for NMOS that I do not have to care about it. But many of these theories were verified with NMOS. PMOS, it turns out, has an even lower leakage current. Because remember, PMOS is like a Zener tunneling. It goes from the valence band to the conduction band. It has a higher barrier. So current is a little bit smaller to begin with. It is the minority ionization that killed it. And so as a result, both for NMOS and PMOS, this works out very nicely. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, yes. Current goes up, yes. Yes, so the question you are asking, and which is what I am about to explain, what you just said that, it's like somebody, let me not give you a human example, but the thing is that once you have a defect, the question is the probability of having other defects nearby enhances or not? Right? That's what you're saying. If it does, I'm in trouble because the second breakdown will happen very quickly. If somebody has a very bad heart attack and in that case he cannot recuperate, then the probability of the second one happening could be much higher. On the other hand, if it is so soft that it really is not correlated, it really didn't affect other ones, then in that case you wouldn't worry, right? Okay, so let me show you the correlation effect, because what I'm going to show you, when you have oxides thin, then it is not correlated. You can experimentally show it. But when the oxide gets thicker, that's as some of the people were saying here, as the oxides gets thicker, let's say 200 angstrom, 500 angstrom, then the defect generation is correlated. And when you are looking at thunderstorm, obviously it's correlated. Once you have a strike, the branching, that happens because the defect generation has become all correlated, right? So there is this distinction between thin and thick oxides that you will have to understand. Okay, so let's say a few more slides, and this is the last topic before I end. Correlated versus uncorrelated damage. Exactly, it's good prelude to this topic. When we say soft breakdown happening in an uncorrelated way, what we mean by that when the jumps in the currents are occurring, in that case, they occur at random points. And they are not, because if you had correlated one, the first one has weakened the nearby points so much that the second, third one all happens very quickly. That would be very bad. And that's something we have to think about. Now, there's one, something called a spatially correlated. That's one, because they are happening all together. But even if they are away from each other, they could be temporally correlated. Somehow the defect generation rate may go up, somehow. Right? So if either of this happens, then the lifetime improvement I told you about will not be as good, right? So that's something one has to worry about. You know, in this field, that's what I was saying, that it looks like it's reliability, you know, empirical thing, put a line through somewhere. But at the end, so much rides on this that if you make a mistake, you can cost people a lot of money. And you have to be very careful. You can lose your job. That's the first thing. And so you have to be extremely careful about what you do. It's not theory. It's not a game. So let me explain to you how to do this. And that is something that's very interesting, the tools that you use to do it. So the question people asked, that are you absolutely sure this is uncorrelated? Because if it is correlated, maybe I will be in trouble. Are you absolutely sure? And then it turns out this nice vertical column binomial theorem I was telling you, you cannot do it. That assumes random trap generation. Now, you cannot just use it to do correlated trap generation, because then the traps will be forming close to each other. The random assumption of Poisson statistics will not work. And you can do it by computer, by Monte Carlo, you can do it, no problem. But the thing is, it turns out that there is something called a Markov chain that you can map this problem. And that was for the first time, I think, that type of idea has been used in this field. Let me explain very briefly. You don't really have to understand the details, but see whether you get the flow. So I'm trying to see how much correlation there is. Assume this thought experiment, that I have a bowl, and in that bowl, I have put 100 oxides, and I'm testing them. What's going to happen? Well, after a while, initially it had no faults. These are sort of, M is on the vertical side, N is on the side, right? And you can think about percolation grid sitting in between, which I'm not showing. A little bit later, what's going to happen from this bowl, it is going to go to another bowl where I have one breakdown. So I have drawn one line. These are constantly being stressed, right? So a little bit later, from this bowl, few more will come down here, few more will come down here, and there will be a cascade of this. So as the more defects, you see there are two breakdown paths here. Do you see that? So there is this cascade will go on. Now, if there is any correlation, I will call that correlation parameter xi. And if it is completely independent, then xi will be zero. If it is correlated, then this xi will be higher than zero. And this will make this water flow a little bit faster. This is a Markov process, correlated Markov process. And you can write an equation, you know, an undergraduate equation. You can say dp naught d chi, and chi I'm coming to a second. P naught is the probability of not having any stripes. D chi is related to time. And it is proportional to p naught, how many I had, and the rate of breakdown. And you can see from this side, things can only go out, nothing can come in, right? So you have that. For the second one and the third one and fourth one, of course, things are coming in from one side, going out in another side. So you have kn minus 1 and kn and dp and dt. So this is dp2 d chi. And then you can write a series of equations like this. Now, one thing first to notice, look at the chi. Chi, this is a very strange differential equation. I don't know anybody has written this type of equation before. that it has a t to the power beta, and beta could be any variable, integer or non-integer, you see, depending on the oxide thickness. So it's a very strange differential equation, and even more stranger is the fact that you can solve this equation. Because this one I can solve, right? You can solve this one. This is an exponential, you know, circuits. You have this, this you can solve. But the thing is that then you can insert this P naught into this one, and then it becomes something that you know, right? What is that? You can integrate by parts, the integrating factor, and then you can solve the series. And it turns out if you think hard enough, this will be your solution. You can figure it out. This is correct. And when xi is equal to 0, xi is equal to 0, this whole thing becomes 1, and you get back your Poisson statistics. You get back that. If, on the other hand, xi is more than 1, then there is correlation, and they will fail faster than otherwise they would have. This you can take and compare with theory. So first of all, I just wanted to check whether I do it by Monte Carlo, whether the result will be the same. And Monte Carlo, this is that 1 over chi, e to the power minus chi, and the Monte Carlo are this, you know, noisy thing. And the analytical things are the theory that I just told you about correlated breakdown. These are continuous lines. So you put them in. Looks very good. It really works. By the way, this is the same physics of the island size distribution that I was using before. The counting techniques are exactly the same. And so you can then go ahead and compare with experiments. And these are the experimental data. This is experimental data, and you can show that the correlation xi and the dotted lines are based on this correlation theory, that do you have any correlation? And the correlation only if that parameter xi is on the order of 5 to 10, then you have to worry. It turns out it's only 0.25. Experiment says that it's 0.25, and that's why 0.25. Therefore, essentially, it's a tiny correlation. Yes, you have correlation, but is so tiny that you don't worry about it. And that is how the circuit will remain functional. Now, the final thing in the next two slides, and then we'll be done, is this very interesting problem that, okay, you have done correlation, a bunch of math, time to break down, but how do you see where the breakdown is? You know, can you do it in a microscope? No hope. Because the resolution of this will be on the order of maybe a 5 angstrom by 5 angstrom, a little vertical path. There is nothing, no analytical technique that you can have to look at them and see they are happening at like a water fountain coming up from the ground at different points. How do you know where they break? And it turns out, this is a problem I have often given, I shouldn't give out this information, in the qualifying exam. And this is how it works. Because all it needs is a first year graduate or undergraduate or second year undergraduate education. Okay, so how do you do that? Assume you have a breakdown here. What happens? So there is a jump in the gate current, right? Jump in the gate current. What happens to the source and drain current if it is sort of breaking at point X? So what's going to happen that as the electron is coming in, this is just jump in the current, one electron will diffuse this way, a bunch of electron, the other thing will diffuse the other way. Right? The bunch of partition, they will partition. Can you solve this problem? What is the ratio? Very easy, actually. If the injection point is at N naught, and the position is XBD, which is unknown. If the channel length is LC, then you have on one side, you have LC over XBD, the other side, you have XBD. Now, let's go through this. Now, I have the current, which is diffusion current and drift current. There should be a Q. Now, I don't have any drift. I'm not applying any drain bias or anything. Drains are grounded. So, I better take out that. Oh, what happened to the electric field? Okay, I'm going to drop it, so it doesn't exist. Then then divergence of J without any recombination is zero. So the second derivative is equal to zero. You can see I like diffusion equation. And the solution of this is AX plus B, right? You know that. That's the bipolar transistor, the base of a bipolar transistor without recombination. Do you remember? It goes linearly. Okay. And then the current is essentially the derivative of this. So therefore, the concentration at the percolation point, and divide by X plus, that will be this current. And the other current will be this. So therefore, if I measure the drain current and the source current and take the ratio, then you can see it immediately tells me the point where the thing broke. It sort of makes sense, right? If it's in the middle, then on both sides, the current will be equal. If it is close to the drain, shouldn't the current in the drain will be larger than the current in the source? That's what it's trying to tell you. So every time things break, you know, jumps, you just sit down there with two probes on the source and drain and measure the corresponding jump in the source and drain. If you see a jump in the drain current more than the source current, you know it's close to the drain or the other way around. And you can then calculate with a nanometer precision. No AFM will do. With a nanometer precision, where your oxides broke. Yes.
How much time do you expect this, like, what is the value of JD by JS plus JD?
What is the value? So it can be this ratio? Yeah, you can tell me. This can be zero if JD is zero. Individual value of JD. How much is it? On the order of few tens of microamps? You can see, you can answer that question. Remember, all you have to do is to look at the jump, and the sum of the two currents cannot exceed the gate current. So you can see that they will partition. Yes?
I think it works if you consider the breakdown like one point by one point. If like two out of same time breaks have...
Same time. Simultaneously, right? Then of course I cannot do it. If it happens in the same time.
So it's possible to break down.
No, that is highly unlikely. You know, the highly unlikely meaning this is forming a percolating path. So you have one defect and you have a low enough voltage. So probability of two of them being incipient at the same time, both finishing at the same time. This is like, it will be like finishing Boston Marathon. Both at the same time. You can have it, unlikely. But if you don't, if they are say, sequentially happening, you can always subtract off the background and just look at the delta every time as if it's a new delta coming out and then partition. There's another question. Yes?
If you think about this problem in two dimensions,
yes.
You don't have an electric field. So the current can diffuse in all directions. So how do you So basically, this method will fail.
The answer to this question is that this is a beautiful question because this bothered me for a long time. And I went to Professor Dutta's office to just discuss this problem because it was sort of bothering me because the computer was telling me that it doesn't matter. And so long the lines are parallel. I will answer just like yesterday your question on the blackboard. It has to do with how you think. If you close your eyes and move a movement along the perpendicular to the channel and open your eye, you cannot make any distinction. You know, all my things have to do with closing your eyes and opening your eyes. So you will see I can prove in 2D, so long the lines are infinite, then this theory is exactly right, even in 2D, although it's a point. And that is something that can be proven. The amazing thing is, even if it's a finite sample, that problem is also analytically solvable. And you know, the first person who solved this, the problem analytically, is Ramanujan. You know Ramanujan is from the Indian mathematician. So he, in fact, solved the problem of if you have a point in somewhere, then how do you, if a rectangular bar. No, he was not using rectangular bar. But this is one of the math problems that allows. So even in 2D, analytical solutions are possible. Yeah. So So this is a beautiful mathematical problem, but that is, people are already probably a little tired of math, so no more math. So you can see from the jumps, you can detect them and show them they are spatially uncorrelated. And then, of course, this is Dhanav Varghese, who is a graduate student in our group. We made this, we got these structures. This is, you can see four terminals. This is a top view. Four terminals, source, drain, contact, the gate. And then you are having breakdown in various points. This is the corresponding boundary, and you can solve these problems. You can see where the breakdowns happens. You can, from the source drain and four terminal current measurements, you can find out where they are breaking. And once you have done that, and you can show that they are essentially spatially uncorrelated. Without this, you have to be very careful. This is not a game. It's not just a few numbers on a board. Because it can be a difference between a company surviving and not. So you have to be careful. Okay, so let me conclude then. So what I tried to tell you is thin oxides are very interesting. And it is really remarkable that anything works at all. There's a lot of interesting things underneath happening that allows these things to happen. So there's two things. Statistical distribution is very bad. 10 to the power 13 electron, 13 transistors are playing bingo, and only a vertical line of five, one will declare, we will call himself a winner. Only thing that allows us to survive, because the person who is calling out the bingo numbers, calling out very slowly. So therefore, the person doesn't win before 10 years. Rate of trap generation is so low that even under this extraordinarily long tail, then together, things remain reliable. And of course, this uncorrelated defect generation in thin oxides, that's a very important thing. I tried to use it also as a way of showing why ballistic transport, prediction of ballistic transport and hot contacts, contact being important, those predictions are fundamentally verified by this long before they probably would be verified in short channel transistor. You probably will not have this type of clean signatures even if you go even to 10 degree Kelvin and in a short channel transistor, because there could be other effects that could come in. And the physics of statistical distribution of failure times and length scaling, these are essentially, so length scaling, remember 1 over L squared, I said that as you make the channel length smaller, Ohm's law is dead, and you have to have the width scaling and all those things. It turns out those two are exactly the same physics. That's why they work, because they are same statistical thing. Only thing I did in reliability, I introduced a time t, so that the n at lower t will always be smaller than n at higher t. That is the only distinction. And that caused all sorts of other implications. So time and space, these two things are not the same. Time goes in only in one direction. And so that makes this reliability prediction is slightly different and have different meaning than what you have expected otherwise. Okay? All right then, thank you. Okay, so some more questions? Yes. This may give you a job, so it's interview questions. You can ask me, and then later on. Yes.
How do you determine the safe operating voltage in the PMOS or NMOS? And in the IGRS roadmap plot that you were showing, we see that at an oxide thickness of about 5 nanometers, the safe operating voltage of PMOS is greater than NMOS. Why is it so?
Very, very nice question. So he's asking that if everything I said is true, then how come it is lower here, and what happened when it was higher? Why was PMOS was fine in the old days, and why is now not good anymore? Right? That's your question. Okay. You can answer that question by looking at the diagram. Again, it's a purely a contact effect. Where is my PMOS? You see, there is this there's these two effects that are trying to compete. One is that the electron tunneling current for PMOS is actually smaller. Right? Why is it? Because this total barrier height is actually higher by a EV corresponding to the other one. One case 3 EV, another case 4 EV. So your tunneling current is actually smaller, quite a bit smaller, because this is exponential suppression, right? Transmission coefficient. Now, this one is actually whole generation. Alpha is much higher. The effective alpha that can get through is much higher. And so therefore, the question is, which one wins? When you have thick oxide, this current is so strongly suppressed, right? Therefore, you do not have the second process to begin with. Only when the oxide starts getting thinner, then the two magnitude becomes comparable so that the other one can take over. That is the reason in 5 nanometer, this PMOS was much more reliable than the NMOS. Okay, that was the question, right? Okay. So, the way it works, this is an NMOS, and what is the, my Fermi level is not where it's supposed to be, right? Fermi level should be here. It's inverted. Again, I should be careful here. I'll pull down the Fermi level. But the thing is, you realize I'll have to apply a positive voltage in order to invert the channel. So the electron will go from here to here, tunnel, impact ionize meaning this will drop down, lose its energy, and whatever energy it lost will be taken by this electron. That electron will go up. These two electrons will get out through the gate, right? And the hole, since it can go to the other side, the field is favorable, hole will be injected back. This is the process. Now, for the PMOS, of course, the same thing can happen. That for the PMOS, by the way, this is the substrate on the right and the gate is on the left. What voltage do I apply in a PMOS in order to invert it? I apply a negative bias. I apply a negative bias. So you can see if this is grounded, the other thing will be pulled up. Now, of course, there's no electron in here, right? PMOS poly is P poly. And so therefore, only electron is the C of these electrons that will try to tunnel. Once they tunnel on the other side, they will impact ionize. They have the option of coming down only up to the conduction band and kicking somebody from the bottom and pull them up, and together they go through the gate. On the other hand, they also have this small pocket. This small pocket. Oh, this is dead, I guess. This small pocket over here, where the electron from the top can drop down because it has an empty state, and it can give all its energy to somebody who is deep under the Fermi C. You see, generally when you do linear response, you know, then you don't worry about, you think that the ones that are way down in the Fermi C, they play no role. Yes, generally that's true, but these are hot contacts. Things that are happening way down in the Fermi C, they play a big role. And they get injected back. The two electrons essentially will get back. Is it clear? Explanation? Okay. What else? Yes, please.
So, in all this lifetime estimation, what we have been assuming is that we have been estimating the lifetime using the failure of one particular transistor. But if I consider it from a circuit viewpoint, usually I have multiple redundancies and people use majority voting and similar kind of techniques. And I would actually assume that that would increase the lifetime quite a lot, because A, it's two or more transistors, identical transistors should fail at the same time for a particular.
Absolutely.
As well as, since they are at different physical locations,
they could be uncorrelated.
So, I guess this is kind of an underestimation of
So let me answer. So here's a very nice question. Again, these are all beautiful questions. So he is saying that in circuits, there may be redundancy. That, you know, instead of having doing one microprocessor doing the job, in principle, you could have four microprocessors in parallel doing the same thing. And on the output, you take the majority voting, that if somebody has failed, it doesn't matter. You still have four others saying that, no, no, this should be the correct operation. You see, this has a beautiful history. And it is coming back in many respects, but it is not universal. The history is this, that in 1940s, the problem was that the vacuum tube, and that is the thing, that is why solid-state transistors were sort of so much desired, is because vacuum tubes used to fail so often that he had to use redundancy. And the person who worked out all the theories are von Neumann. Von Neumann had this majority voting algorithms, series parallel connections, and he worked out all the things that I didn't talk about, how to have the stable points. You know, remember Obama-McCain thing that I talked about? He was one of the first person to look at the stable points and see how the redundancy may work. And the other person who thought it out is the person who is doing this coding. Who is the coding theory? Who did the initial coding? Huh? Shannon? But before that. You know, remember the problem was that they will punch holes in the punch card. And of course, if your one punching is wrong, then your whole instruction is wrong. So therefore, you spread this out and you use the redundancy, right? You use extra bits as redundancy so that even when you make errors, the whole thing, huh? Who? Hamming. So Hamming, essentially, because when you, with the two redundancy, redundant code, what you're doing, you are essentially increasing the space between things so that even when you make an error. So these techniques were sort of in 1940s and 50s, these were became very, very popular, of course. Gradually then, however, the products that Intel was in the beginning was selling, these are low-cost products. You don't want to have redundancy. And these were generally much more reliable than before. And lifetime was so much that in the beginning, they didn't really do too much majority voting. Nowadays, every time there is a satellite, you know, the reason you cannot send people to Mars is because of the radiation problem. Because here, of course, radiation is... And the radiation, anytime radiation effect is that important, you have to do majority voting, right? You have to do. But you are paying a price. And you wouldn't want it. You want your iPod at the minimum possible cost. For memory, right, flash memory, many times you are putting your error correction code. But I have been in the management, so I know that every time you try to put a bit and it increases the price by a few dollars, how much resistance is there from the salespeople? So, yes, of course, depending on the problem, it has to come back in many ways. Probably it's already, you may already know that it may already be coming back in a quite a big way. So the thing is that you have to play this game. See how much you can live with. Do we really need 1 in 10,000? Maybe 1 in 100 is fine. You increase your price a little bit. Yes, if you can do redundancy, that's great. That will help, yes. Anything else? Okay then, thank you.